Hello, and welcome to another episode of Underground Antics. I'm your host, Shane Parkroy, and my guest today is the wonderful Larry Linton, who is a dear family friend of ours. And today you're on to talk about your past and your experience living with Parkinson's disease and how that's affected your life and how you've managed to combat certain areas of it and really make the most out of, you know, what's a pretty rough situation. And I'll just start off by saying that a lot of the things that we're going to talk about is in the book that you have over here, which is called Shaken Not Stirred, Living with Parkinson's Disease, which people can purchase, which I highly recommend. It's a great book. And thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be able to share my story. So thanks for the opportunity.
Sure. So how about we start off, maybe could you just give us a brief introduction to your story of Parkinson's? When did you get diagnosed? How old were you? What was it like? And then we'll get into it from there.
Yeah, so I'll give you a bit of context. I had lost my father to heart disease when I was 6 and he was 45. So I always thought that my life's health challenge would be to avoid heart disease. And I was shocked when at 49, instead I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, because that threw another curveball at me. But I was diagnosed in 2012. It took about 2 or 3 years to get to that formal diagnosis. Beforehand, I had a constant tremor in my right hand and an even walking gait. I couldn't run any longer. I was an amateur runner at for years before, but noticed that I could hardly walk. I didn't have a natural heel toe gait. So my running days was over, and I tried physiotherapy, acupuncture, intravenous naturopathic remedies, even went to see a Chinese herbalist and prescribed something that tasted as nasty as it looked, and nothing helped. So by the process of elimination and the insistence on my GP to refer me to a neurologist, I finally got to a neurologist, and within 30 minutes, he diagnosed me with adult onset Parkinson's. And that sort of threw me into the next chapter of my life. I mean, I did have a sense of relief at that news, because I finally knew after all those years that I had something. But it was the start of a very difficult chapter, because for the following years, instead of living with the disease, I lived against it and in denial. It was easier for me to deny what I had as opposed to living with it. So that was the start of it in 2012 officially.
So from that initial diagnosis, what made you live against it? What was going through your mind, or what was the big challenge that was difficult to accept? I mean, go ahead.
What happened is that I did a couple of things that if I had my time over, I wouldn't do. The first thing I did when I got back from the neurologist on that day is fired up my laptop and typed in adult onset Parkinson's into Google and YouTube. And I was shocked at the images that I saw and the stories that I read, because I had just arrived from the doctor, and the images and the vocabulary and the stories, I didn't have any terms of reference on how to deal with it. You know, my question was, was I looking at my future self in those images? And that's what threw me into this period of denial. It was easier to shut down the computer and deny what I had, as opposed to looking at all the images, trying to be an expert in the first 72 hours after diagnosis and being overwhelmed with the information and the images that I saw. So that was the start of my dark period of denial, because I just didn't know what to do and what I was looking at to understand what my future life would be.
Right. Yeah, I mean, doing a web search for any symptoms usually ends in more upset than good.
That's right.
But so the neurologist that you went to see, in that consultation, did they not offer you any kind of guidance or support, or, you know, say like, here's some groups that maybe you could go to, or maybe you should look up some information? Or did they just kind of chuck it at you and say, I'll see you soon?
That's exactly the point. I was there for 30 minutes. It had taken me 3 years to get there and 30 minutes of a consultation. I left there with a pamphlet in my hand that was about Parkinson's, and all I remember focusing on were the words chronic, progressive, and incurable. There was no discussion about support services. There was no offer of ongoing assistance. You're pretty much left alone. I left with a script for medication and an invitation to, you know, see you in a month's time. So that is the biggest problem. Looking back now, I would have done things very differently. I think that initial meeting and a follow-up meeting is very important. But at that time in my situation, 10 years ago, it was that 30-minute and I'll see you again in a month.
That must have been really hard, because with such a, you know, diagnosis, which is essentially, I'm sure in some sense it felt like a death sentence, there was just, they offered you nowhere to turn, right?
That's right. And the issue is that, you know, I'm not only did I have the diagnosis having to deal with the physical issues of the illness, but I was mid-career. You know, I still had a job. I mean, I literally walked from my office to the neurologist, but got on the train to come home straight afterwards. I didn't go back to the office, but mid-career, both, you know, myself and my spouse working full-time, teenage kids at home who understood what I was going through. And so it, not only did I have to deal with the illness, but what were the repercussions? Could I continue working? What would happen to my career? Must I disclose it to my employer? So all of those psychological issues weighed probably as much on my mind as the physical side of dealing with the disease.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, it's arguably more difficult to deal with, you know, the psychological and emotional side of things than the physical limitations. I mean, while those are definitely unpleasant and difficult to manage, it's compounded exponentially if you're fighting against it and, you know, sitting in like somewhat of a sense of grief, right? And despair about it. So you said for about 3 years you were in denial and you fought against it. What did that look like?
That was my dark chapter. I withdrew from my family. I started living literally on my couch. I was prone to panic attacks when I left the home. So it became a life of isolation and comfort on my couch. I was making it into the office, but I pretended that I was very busy and buried myself in file work away from my team. Never went to client engagements or team meetings. So I was living this dual life. I mean, I was at work working, but couldn't wait to get home. And when I was at home, I was disengaged from my family to the point of literally sleeping, eating, and, you know, blindly just watching television from my couch. And that sort of went on for a couple of years. I was no longer running. I was not doing anything until I was literally left alone on a Saturday night. My family had decided to go out again because they had run out of excuses for me. And I was literally on the couch, and I just became overwhelmed with a flood of emotions rushing through me. Started with anger. I had reached the point of shouting and swearing at myself, and I started referring myself to in a third person. You know, I started pulling at my hair. I was angry, and then I was overcome with tears, and I became tearful and literally cried my eyes out to the point of exhaustion. And it was at that point of exhaustion that I had another emotion, which then mm-hmm. became very peaceful and lucid. And I realized at that moment that I still had a life to live. I was still a father and a friend. I still had a good job. And looking around the home, I was all alone on the Saturday night. And I thought to myself, this is no way to live. And so I, for those 2 or 3 years, it was definitely a period of grief. And I had to go through those emotions to the point of acceptance. And I think
right.
on my journey with Parkinson's, that took me that time. In other cases, it may take other people less time, or it may take longer. But I remember the day because it was the day that I can confidently say it was my day of acceptance.
Right, the day you got your life back.
Well, I started to get my life back. I realized that I did have a life to live. And that's when I literally got off the couch and started walking on the treadmill and started reclaiming my life slowly but surely over the next couple of years.
Okay, so was that your next step? So after you had this, you know, real intense moment culminating in an acceptance and a realization that, you know, you're not actively dying right now and that you do have time and that you have a life left to live, however that might pan out and for however many years, that there was still hope and there was still brightness in your life. So what did you do from then on? How did you start reclaiming your life back?
So the first thing I did literally was on that Saturday night, I went and got my running gear, you know, reached into the back of my closet because by then my running gear was gathering dust and so was the treadmill in the basement. But I literally got changed and went downstairs and started walking on the treadmill because I wanted to deal with the physicality of my disease. And the easiest thing to do was to fire up the treadmill, start walking. I didn't care any longer because there was nobody there on that Saturday night. So I started walking, and I was walking with a tremendous limp and a sort of a dead right leg, essentially. It was just plodding along. Mm-hmm. But I did that, and I started doing that more consistently every day. And so I introduced walking to start, and then got up to 10 minutes of walking, and then introduced running for 1 minute. And slowly but surely, and this took weeks afterwards, that I started to reclaim and regain a more natural walking gait. And with the running, I was starting to run more evenly. And I just kept plodding along and literally took my running outside. I started jogging in the early morning. And the more I was running, the more I saw that my gait was improving, and also my thought process was beginning to change. But that took weeks and months. But the longer I did it, the better I felt, and convinced myself that I didn't have to worry about the future. I didn't want to live in the past any longer, and the running helped me focus on the present at the time. So that was the start of my physicality in dealing with Parkinson's. And then...
The physicality was the first sign that something was wrong, right? Like this, the difficulty walking, the tremor in your hand. And so that... to you, I guess, would have been the most obvious sign of a quote-unquote problem. And so that's what you were like, I want to deal with this. What can I do?
Correct.
Or what inspired you to start walking? Did you just feel like this is what I need to do?
Well, in my research, I found that exercise was a leading thing to do for the maintenance and control of the symptoms. But I had this limp, so it was a catch-22 situation. I had to push myself through that to start walking and running. And then I you know, my gait improved. But then I took it further. I was a keen drummer in my youth, and I noticed that the other research was with respect to music therapy. So I went down a rabbit hole with that and returned to music and drumming to deal again with the tremors in my hand. So I covered the running for my uneven gait and the drumming to balance me out on the physicality on my tremoring hands. And right. Like my running, the more I stuck with my drumming, the better my hands felt. So that was also a great opportunity to reclaim my love for drumming and help with the physical side of it as well.
Right. I mean, that's amazing. So you started to introduce these new aspects of your life that gave you joy again and, you know, cleared your head and helped you refocus on the present and find some kind of joy in life despite the limitations. And even to a large degree, you know, incredibly improve the physical situation that you were in, right? And so the running did it for your leg and the drumming did it for your hand. And I'm sure mentally they were both excellent for you. You know, there's a lot of research on both exercise and music in terms of mental health, we could say. And so was this the start of like an incline for you?
Yeah, that's correct. Parkinson's is a very complex disease. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's got the images of Parkinson's, the physicality of Parkinson's, the shaking, the tremors. You think of Michael J. Fox and Muhammad right. Ali. But there are a lot of invisible symptoms as well, depression, anxiety, as symptoms of Parkinson's. And I certainly had those. But what I decided to do is, having the success with the running and drumming, I turned to mindfulness to try and reduce my anxiety. So what I did is, like my running and drumming, consistently introduced 15 minutes of mindfulness every day, which I still do. And it's really practical for me, because what I do is I sit quietly and focus on my breath. Mm-hmm. Everything that I've read about mindfulness is all about breathing. I'm not into the heavy theory of mindfulness and the mysticism of mindfulness, mm-hmm. but I certainly find the practicality of mindfulness very beneficial. So it's focusing on your breath, calming breath, conscious exhale, conscious inhale. And I found that has helped me tremendously in dealing with my anxiety. And I can do it, you know, at my desk. I can do it in the car. It did take practice. And I reference in my book some of the tools that I use. And I've got this sort of headband, which is called Muse. Because I didn't really know, you know, anybody can sit in a lotus position and focus on their breath. But the issue is that beneficial? I felt okay, but I needed some objective sort of, reliability and validation of it. So this Muse is a sort of a high-tech headband that you put on, and it actually reads your brain waves in real time. And you can set some software that if you're in a calm state, you can hear waves crashing gently, you know, at low tide. Yeah. Whereas if you are thinking about other thoughts, it becomes a tidal wave of waves crashing, which are much louder. So it gave me the objective criteria to rely on to ensure that I was breathing the right way. And I have found that to be tremendously helpful over the years.
I've used Muse in the past, and it is brilliant. It's a brilliant piece of technology, and I think that anyone can benefit from it. Because you're right, when you're meditating or when you're practicing mindfulness or whatever you would like to call it, it's extremely difficult to know if you're doing it right, if there's even such thing as doing it right, you know, because it's very non-quantitative for the most part, right?
Right.
But this Muse band introduces a quantitative element that can tell you, or at least indicate to you, that you know, your whatever, this part of the brain that we're trying to calm down is active at the moment. And so you can learn how to use internal tools to regulate thought and to regulate how to breathe properly, and if that's having the effect that it should. And then at the same time, embrace what that feels like in that moment, right?
Right, absolutely. And then you can translate that into any aspect whenever you need to.
Yeah.
You know, sitting in the car, you can adopt the same practice.
So
that's where it's helping.
So how did you get onto mindfulness? Was it through like your research that you found that this was helpful for a lot of people?
Yes, I just thought that it was a good way of dealing with the anxiety. I mean, I could have gone back to the doctor to deal with that, because those symptoms, you know, you could get medication.
Yeah.
And I'm on a cocktail of drugs every day, and I didn't want to add anything more to my regime in the morning. So mindfulness was something that I researched. I mean, I've read Napoleon Hill. You know, some of the old classics, but leading theory on it. And I've realized that everything really is about your breath and your thoughts. And I think the two go hand in hand, that if you're mindful, you're living in the present. And that obviously helps me stay grounded in having to deal with Parkinson's, because if I'm grounded, then I'm not worried about the past, and I'm not fixating on the future.
Right.
And I think that that was what my life has turned out to be, that in many respects, I'm living a more rewarding and fulfilling life now with Parkinson's than ever before. And I think mindfulness and intentional living is one of the great benefits that I've got out of having Parkinson's.
Yeah, it's interesting, because it does seem to be the case that often people's greatest challenges turn out to be the catalyst for a transformation of in a positive transformation, and for being able to learn how to live well, right, and live a full life despite the enormity of the challenge. Not that that's to say that it's good that it happened to you or anything like that, but just that, well, given the challenge, that can go in different directions, right? For some people, it'll crush them, and that's unfortunate, and it's sad, and that'll be the end, and it will be, you know, it just makes everything worse indefinitely until death. And then for other people, there is this other option where you can accept this challenge that's been given to you in life, and you can see how and what is the most appropriate way to deal with it and to manage it such that it doesn't crush you, and that there actually is a silver lining, or there can be a silver lining in effect. Right. And as you say, it takes a fortune of hard work. I mean, you had to learn how to walk again, pretty much. You know, you had to learn how to use the mobility and dexterity in your hands again. Mindfulness is a skill, right? It takes a lot of practice. It's not something you can just do like that. And then as a consequence, you're reaping all these benefits now. And as you say, you're living a much more fulfilled life, right? Go ahead.
I've realized that I was given Parkinson's for a reason, and I've come to realize that adversity is a better teacher than success.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, I've learned to be resilient. I've learned to accept the good with the bad, and I think that's what adversity teaches everybody. And I've got a chronic illness, but some other people have adversity in the sense of a career challenge, another health challenge, a relationship challenge. And I think we all tested at certain times in our lives, and I think the resilience factor is overcoming that and living with that adversity. And that's why I believe that it's a better teacher than success, because, you know, I live with this every day. And it's not like I've broken my leg, or I've got a cold or a flu, which is going to pass. Every day I live with it, I get up with it, and I take the good with the bad. You know, some days are better than others. I'm not saying that every day is golden, but in the whole scheme of things, I think that that's what life is all about. And so In a way, I regard myself as lucky because I am living well with Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. I've got a great family support. I'm dedicated to my exercise, and I'm hoping that there is going to be a cure in my lifetime. But in the meantime, I'm just trying to live the best life that I can.
Absolutely.
As authentically as I can.
And I think it's very inspirational. And that definitely comes through in your book that, you know, you want to be an example for people, whether it's people with Parkinson's or, as you say, just anyone who faces adversity, which is everyone. And it comes in different forms and different flavors, and people deal with it differently, and it's required to deal with differently. But the resilience and the ability to take a huge challenge and transform it into something positive is part of the human existence, right? I mean, if everything was fine all the time, life, that's not how life works. I mean, every life form, even plants and animals, face huge challenges all the time that ultimately will result in death at some point. I mean, you know, plants face weather problems and people problems and animals eating them and whatever it is. And then animals have to find food and you know, not get killed by predators. And so there's huge challenges for all living beings. And that's how evolution works, ultimately, is that evolution challenges you and you prevail or not, but hopefully you prevail, right? And you come out stronger on the other side. Now, you mentioned that you're taking a cocktail of meds, right? How has that been for you?
The medication is only to deal with the symptoms. I mean, it's not a cure.
Sure.
So it took me about a year to get the level of medication correct. Mm-hmm. Because with Parkinson's, it's a cyclical progress, and the medication is there to stretch out those cycles to give you the best and maximum mobility throughout the day. So I'm on about 20 meds a day.
Jesus.
And I've timed it, but believe it or not, that's good, because my medication, I haven't increased the dosage for about 10 years.
Wow.
And I credit that with the exercise, because the exercise should be prescribed as medication for Parkinson's.
Sure.
Because that has definitely helped me. And I think that the exercise that I've done has allowed me to level off my meds. And so I'm very thankful, because I've met many people in the community, and unfortunately we all have our distinct paths and journeys with Parkinson's, mm-hmm. and some take a lot more medication and some take no medication because they're just starting out. But you know, this whole topic of medication is an interesting one, because I'm always asked, well, you know, why did you start taking the medication, and would you have delayed and deferred it? And my feeling is that it's not a cure, but the medication is to help you maintain a good quality of life for as long as possible.
Yeah.
So my feeling is that once I've got the level, I take the meds, because I'm still able to enjoy a good quality of life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, by no means am I against medication taking. But you're right that there's a necessary balance between lifestyle factors and medication in terms of maximizing the benefit. I mean, on a sort of separate but related topic, there have been plenty of studies showing that exercise is at least as effective in treating mild to moderate depression and anxiety than traditional antidepressant or anti-anxiolytic medication, which is extraordinary, right, that's the case. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that how much benefit you've gotten from the exercise, right, and how much it's helped you. And there's certainly a neuroplasticity link in that, where your brain can change, right, even up until the end, right? It's constantly evolving and changing. And what's needed, at least in part, is for you to challenge your brain to evolve and to be better and to grow. And through exercise, which is difficult, right? It's not easy, particularly if you have a condition that prevents you from, you know, sort of regular kind of stuff. That makes it all the more difficult. Mm. But I mean, I guess the benefit is even more so in those cases, right? Right. So you would definitely recommend to anyone who's struggling to be like, well, go exercise, go walk for 10 minutes.
Yes, absolutely. I don't expect anybody to run half marathons, yeah. you know, within 5 minutes.
Sure.
But certainly to get out and just be active and do something physical is better than doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I believe in the 1% improvement every day. In other words, you know, you can sit on the couch on a Monday, but on Tuesday, get off the couch and walk up the stairs or down the stairs a few times. That's 1% increase. Get outside and then walk 5 minutes and then increase it. Anything is better than nothing, mm-hmm. in my opinion. But the interesting thing with Parkinson's is that it's an ongoing issue. And my most recent challenge is the cognitive side of things.
Right.
And that's unfortunately what I'm dealing with now. You know, I'm starting to lose words, starting to stammer a bit. And people who don't know about Parkinson's think that in a social setting, when I'm starting to lose words or I start slurring, it's a sign of drunkenness.
Hmm.
And I've had to deal with that. So when you talk about the neuroplasticity, I think it's a real thing. And what I'm focusing on now is trying to incorporate, as I've done with the physical exercise and the mindfulness, doing things around cognitive improvements as well, doing crosswords, reading, journaling,
right.
doing everything I can to deal with those symptoms as well, because there's no question that the progress of this disease is ongoing, mm-hmm. and it does interrupt careers, which happened to me. So that it's a whole area there of, you know, I don't look sick, but a lot of it is in my head
right.
now, more than anything else. And so what I'm thankful for is the way I have been able to react to those ongoing issues with Parkinson's, because essentially cognitive impairment is a sort of a second diagnosis
mm-hmm.
Of the disease. The first is usually the physical symptoms as I've described.
Sure.
But when I got that sort of second diagnosis based on the mindfulness and the benefits that I've incorporated, I was able to react in a calmer, more rational way in dealing with that, as opposed to the first diagnosis, which threw me into a complete downward spiral.
Right.
At least now I can deal with it in a more calm and rational manner.
Yeah. Listen, I mean, I'm sure it's really difficult and scary to have cognitive decline do you have a sense of that you're losing part of yourself? Is that part of it? Or is it just that you're struggling to do what you used to do, kind of thing?
I think the issue most recently is my world seems to be getting smaller. So I've had to consciously do things to not make it smaller. So when I'm playing the drums mm. now, I sing and I'm a bad singer. But okay. also I try and exactly, yeah. nobody's no. listening, especially these days when you're not playing live.
Right.
So I'm just aware of it, and I seek patience in my family. I don't like it when they complete my words or complete my sentences. I make them wait for me to, you know, contribute to a conversation and complete and finish my thought process. It seems to be working, and I'm not too fussed about it because it's just the nature of the game, and I take the good with the mm-hmm. bad. When I take my meds in the morning, I'm much better until about, you know, the afternoon sessions where I've got to take my next hit of meds. And so I pace myself and I take the good with the bad, and I've learned to laugh with this condition as well. As scary as it is, it helps me keep grounded and not worry about the future too much.
Absolutely, because you can definitely get lost in your thoughts about how bad things could be or might be, or you don't even know, right? And you don't know at all what the future is going to hold. I mean, either of us might die in a car crash tomorrow, and then none of that matters, right? You really have to be here now and be able to enjoy your life, the good and the bad, and bring it with you. Now, we've spoken briefly about work and how it's affected your work, right? And for the beginning part, you know, when you were initially diagnosed, you said you spent quite a lot of time trying to hide it from people. At what point did that change?
It reached a point where I couldn't perpetuate the denial any longer. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's the issue with lying, is that you've always got to remember the lie. And I just the more I was denying it, the worse I felt. I had panic attacks going into the office on the train because I knew that I had a meeting and I had to disguise who I was. So when I got my medication and my physical side under control, I decided to, you know, firstly tell my team that I had Parkinson's. But they knew, and I sat down with them and I said, well, listen, team, I just wanted to share some news with you. For the last couple of years, I've been battling with Parkinson's. They were shocked, but they weren't surprised because they said, Larry, we knew something was up, but we didn't want to bring it up or talk to you about it. And I had a tremendous sense of relief when I told my team. Yeah. And then I told my boss. And again, it was very supportive. But unfortunately, most recently with the cognitive symptoms and challenges, it definitely had an impact on my performance. And so I had this, you know, this issue of, is my disease affecting my performance, or am I just a bad performer? But thankfully, in my case, I had disclosed. So there was the natural discussion whether or not it was my disease that was impacting my performance. Mm-hmm. With other people that I've met in the community, they try and keep quiet for as long as possible. And that concerns me because if, you know, there's a duty to accommodate once an employer knows about a disability. Mm-hmm. But if they don't know, your performance may be... may result in you being fired. So it's this whole topic of disclosure and when to disclose, how to disclose, is very difficult and a minefield to navigate. But in my case, I took the high road because it made me feel better. I knew that I could engage with my team, and if I was having an off day, for example, they knew that I was okay and just had to, you know, leave and take my laptop with me and rest. So it did help me with my dealing with my anxiety, and also just it allowed me to continue working without having to hide it any longer.
Right. I think that's great because, as you say, like, people can't help you if they don't know. If you don't let them help you, there's nothing that's going to happen. Right. And it's interesting because I imagine that I can totally empathize with why people would want to hide it. Right. And perhaps there's some shame involved. Perhaps there's fear of what the consequences might be. And all that put together, it's no wonder you were having panic attacks. I mean, that your anxiety must have been through the roof because you're worried about how you look, how you're coming across, the stories you've told people. Do they know? Don't they know? What happens if they know? Am I going to lose my job? What's going to happen? Endless kind of rumination is possible, right?
Correct.
But it's amazing that you were so well received by your team and by your boss that, you know, were compassionate towards you and they understand. And they said, well, we knew something was going on because we know you. We've worked with you for a few years. And while we didn't know what it was or perhaps how serious it was, now that we do know, we can, we'll do what we can to accommodate and do what's needed. Right. And so it is important that people tell their employers. Now, you're right. It is a minefield because depending on your work situation, will depend on how well that's going to go. And depending on who your team and your boss is, it might not go so well. But even so, perhaps it's a catalyst for you to find something where you are accepted and welcomed and accommodated where needed. And if it's not this particular place, then perhaps that's a good thing still, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, I mean it must be terribly difficult. No, go ahead, please.
Yes. Yeah, and what I've really come to realize is that there's a lot of opportunity to educate employers with invisible diseases because, you know, people can still look at me and say, well, you look great, Larry. How can you be disabled? Mm-hmm. And so I'm very involved in that as well, in trying to coach employees to disclose,
right,
despite the ramifications that they may feel. But also I'm very impressed with some other firms out there that are starting to look at neurodiverse workforces. And I think that's a very interesting area to think about as well. And if I ever get back to corporate, I'd love to get back into the space of neurodiversity, because I think the world is changing, and I think we still, you know, those that have chronic illnesses or neurodiverse challenges and differences are still valuable and still have a contribution to make. So I know I'm very involved in the Parkinson's community, but I'd like to you know, use my experience and my lived experience to convince employers to hire neurodiverse people. We're still valuable, mm-hmm, and we can still contribute and still do a good job. And I think that's my sort of my next soapbox sort of, you know, approach.
Absolutely.
To life in my next chapter.
Good. I mean, could you perhaps explain a little bit what you mean by neurodiverse?
Yeah, so there are a couple of firms who have got these centers of excellence where they consciously go out to hire people that are on the neurodiverse spectrum, people with autism, epilepsy, attention deficit disorder. Mm-hmm. Because the research that I've done, I've found that a lot of people in this category are either unemployed or underemployed, and don't typically, you know, fit into the mode of the usual job specs that are posted. So there's some firms that consciously overcome that and go out to recruit this type of workforce, because it for specialized projects that they may be involved with, because some people can look at a cybersecurity decoding differently by a neurodiverse individual than a neurotypical individual. So there are a lot of benefits there. So I'm interested in that because I have obviously a very serious disease, but I still come from that neuro world, and I know what it's like to be valued, and I know what it's like to be not valued, mm-hmm, once you disclose. So I'm looking, my world is to have the ability to be yourself, and we should be celebrating all of our differences as differently abled as opposed to disabled.
Absolutely. And I think that's a hugely important point, is that just because someone has some difference doesn't mean that they're better or worse at, I mean, perhaps at any individual given task, you could make an assessment, but you can't make a general statement that says, you know, all this or that way is going to work. And you're right. I mean, there's an incredible amount of avenues where the diversity is actually much more beneficial, right? And now, sure, I'm sure it comes with different challenges, but there's always challenges, right? You have challenging employees regardless of who they are. I mean, that's the nature of working with humans, is that we're challenging creatures most of the time, or a lot of the time at least.
That's right.
And so I think that would be great. That's a great area to work in. And it's good to hear that there are a lot of organizations that actually are working towards that, or trying at least open to the idea. And yeah, I mean, I guess it can't be everyone, you know, because certain jobs require certain things that, you know, like it wouldn't be wise for you to go into construction, for example, like as a construction.
Yes, no, absolutely.
Like, I don't think that would make the most amount of sense, but you would agree with that because it's not necessarily the right fit, right? But there are plenty where it Correct. Where it could work perfectly and where accommodations can be made wherever if and wherever needed. And that's great, right? So you do see that that there's a transformation in the corporate world in a positive direction in this sense.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. I saw a picture on the new face of Gucci is a young lady who is has Down syndrome. And I think if Gucci are doing that, I think we're into a brighter world out there, where differences are celebrated.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great world to live in.
Absolutely. Now, the last point that I wanted to chat to you about was the impact that it's had on your family and how perhaps we can even broaden it to your social networks in general, right? Like, how does this affect it? Like, yeah, I mean, I know you touched on how sometimes people can, you know, if they're in a rush, they can interrupt you and think that it's easier to just finish your sentence instead of letting you finish your thought process or concluding what you were trying to say. And I think people feel that, you know, similarly, people who have stutters or something like that, they also often get unintentionally shut down, right? And people try and like help them almost, even though that's not the right way of approaching it, right? But other than that, like, it certainly must have had a big impact on your wife and your kids in terms of what this means for your life as a family, right? And even to some degree about how the future is going to unfold, which I guess you don't really know, but does it come up a lot? Like, do you discuss it with your family? Is it important to talk about certain aspects or not? Is it well received by some and not by others? Like, what's your experience been?
Yeah, I've been lucky because I'm surrounded by obviously a loving and supportive family that have all gone into the health business. Mm-hmm. And my wife's a personal trainer. My daughter is a kinesiologist and back at school studying chiropractic medicine. My son is involved in the healthcare industry as well and a personal trainer. So I'm lucky in the sense that I'm surrounded by people that look at me and help me. I'm probably their worst customer because I don't listen to what they say. But it allows me to be myself. And when I started my story with you, Shane, I spoke about losing my father, you know, when I was very young. So that having the opportunity to be a dad all those years ago, I really relished that opportunity and have had tremendous relationship with my kids. And I've realized that over my 10 years now with Parkinson's is that I've got the disease, but the burden and falls to my family as well. So I try and live the best life that I can because then I know it lessens their burden. But I know that I can rely on them when I'm having a bad day.
Sure.
But thankfully, over my journey, I have more better days than bad days. But, you know, I think it all comes down to relationships and being open, as I was open with my team. It's being open with your family first and foremost, because they're the people that support you tremendously. And I regard myself as lucky because my condition and the way we've been living has sustained and improved my relationship with my family. In many cases, I've heard of just the opposite, where, you know, the burden and the stress of the disease does not have that outcome. It has a worse outcome with breakups and divorces and things like that. But in my case, I don't think I could have completed half marathons, completed drumming, continued with my career, to the point of being admitted as a partner after my diagnosis without my fundamental family in my corner.
That's amazing. And it's so important to have a good support system, right? And you had also briefly touched on how you're working in the Parkinson's like community, for lack of a better word, to offer support and guidance and lived experience from your experience with your family, from your experience at work, and being, you know, getting these diagnoses and managing that and just trying to figure it all out. And so a support system is definitely crucial, because otherwise you're fighting the battle alone, which you needn't do, right? And in fact, it arguably can often be worse to do it that way for everyone, not just yourself. You know, I've found like keeping things from people when you think you're trying to protect them doesn't always pan out as planned, right? Because people aren't stupid and they know what's up. And then if if you're not sharing things with them, then in their mind, they're going to guess what's happening. And it's often much worse than the reality of the situation, right? Because we tend to be quite catastrophic thinkers. And so what is the support community like? Are there like peer support groups that people can look to, meetings? How does it work?
Yeah, Parkinson Canada is obviously the national voice of people affected by Parkinson's and support for their caregivers as well. And when I look back on my experience, I wish I would have been reached out to Parkinson Canada a lot earlier, because it took me about 7-8 years to get to my first support group meeting. And sitting around the table at my, in the good old days when we could do it live and in person, I managed to, you know, be myself and have questions and answers right there and then, as opposed to what I did trying to find those answers myself on my own. And I have forged great, genuine friendships out of the support groups. And I think they do a tremendous job. I do think, however, that, you know, the support groups have got to be specialized in the sense of, I'm not an 80-year-old with Parkinson's. I was 45, and therefore the support groups have got to be tailored to our issues and concerns and challenges. But in terms of this, the support has been tremendous, and that's what, by me, Parkinson's is all about. I've got the disease, but the burden is felt by my family. But the support, though, is wider, and I think there's tremendous support in the safety in numbers and the ability to share our experiences to benefit. And that's why I put my hand up to be involved more with the community. I'm the first chair of the Parkinson's Advisory Council, where the voice of the Parkinson's community is now at the table at Parkinson's Canada, to make sure that the voice of the people essentially is heard in its strategic direction.
As opposed to who else was at the table at Parkinson's Canada?
There was nobody. There was the support groups and the peer-to-peer group support system, but the voice of the community was not officially and formally at the table. And so this is a tremendous opportunity where we move essentially from being passive users of the services by Parkinson Canada to actively become active participants in the creation of those services.
So it's
listen to the voice and therefore devise the service that suits and deals and meets with those challenges that we all go through.
So I mean that's really amazing, you know, and support groups are, especially specialized support groups, are hugely beneficial, as you say, to have that shared experience or similar experience and be able to see that it's not just you and that people deal with it differently and that, you know, there are people that overcome major setbacks, which perhaps could be inspirational and like a mentor like kind of situation where there's guidance opportunities and things like that. And in our world today, like, there are these big movements for these kinds of, you know, issues where people and you know, actually the internet's a really great tool for it, despite its limitations. And you know, being on a call over Zoom or whatever is not quite the same, but it allows people to get together and to, you could theoretically have a, you know, a full, almost a full friendship with someone who lives in Africa or Asia or Australia or wherever, and just share experience and get to bond that way, right? And so that's a really amazing thing.
And to a certain extent, the pandemic has forced us to do that. But when it comes to Parkinson's, it's actually quite interesting, because it's forced the doctors to look at us in our own environments. And so my discussion with my neurologist is now over Zoom at different times of the day, so that they can see us in our home environment. So that's what it's all about. And I think the support service does go across the country. With Parkinson's, for example, we have a monthly meeting, and it's really everybody across the country. And I think we've all got this shared experience to rely on. So there's one good thing about the pandemic, is that it's forced us to think differently about the use of technology and the delivery of support and care services.
Absolutely. And there's also great research into the Parkinson field, right? Like at universities and science centers and whatever, in terms of trying to find better ways of treatment and potentially, hopefully, a cure at some point. And it is promising. I mean, it's an extraordinarily complicated condition, right? And so it makes sense that it's difficult to manage and to be able to find general cures, so to speak, right? Because it's not going to manifest the same every case. And so it's very, very difficult.
That's right. It's a very complex disease, and we all have our different journeys. And I know that there are a lot of people hard at work trying to find a cure. Mm. But until then, you know, I can only do what I can do, and that's living the best life that I can through my exercise and sharing my story, in the hope that a cure will be coming, and that we can talk about, you know, having Parkinson's in the past tense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that would be amazing if we can reach that point at some stage. Yeah. So perhaps to end off, just how, if someone were to come to you today and say, I've just been diagnosed with Parkinson's, right? I'm, let's say, middle-aged, or younger or older, whatever it is, right? How would you suggest, what would you tell someone, just, you know, without getting too much into the nitty-gritty of it, what kind of advice would you give to someone in that situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would, if I had to do that now, I would say to people that your life is not over. Mm-hmm. It may take a while to get to that point of acceptance, but you still have value. You still have a job to do. You still are a family member, and your life still has meaning. Mm-hmm. And to some people that are not diagnosed, I tell them, live your life as if you have been diagnosed, because that diagnosis is a life-altering event. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that it's the start of the end. It could be the start of something better.
Right.
And that's what I would encourage people to realize, is that you could live with a chronic illness, you can live with Parkinson's, and you must commit to living well, but you still have a life to live.
Right. Yeah, I think that's great. Well, anyway, listen, Larry, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Likewise,
thank you. I will put links to your book and to Parkinson's Canada and various resources like that in the descriptions of the podcast for anyone who's interested in learning more. But yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for your time.
All right, take care.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.